and welcome to the Hear It podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Roberts, and I'll be speaking with guests about the campaigns, insights and ideas to better engage youth audiences. I really hope you like it. This episode, we welcome Kyle Campbell to the Hear It podcast. Kyle founded The Education Marketer, having amassed a breadth of experience at different institutions. And as well as consulting, he's a self-confessed writer, content marketing evangelist, and internet culture nerd. His newsletter updates and Education Marketer podcast, as well as a heap of LinkedIn posts, will keep you for the most out of touch across the latest developments, issues, and opportunities when it comes to education marketing. Welcome to the Hear It podcast, Kyle.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's jump straight in. Sometimes keeping on top of the latest trends and developments feels like a bit of a race, kind of like how people have to have a hot take on ChatGTP on LinkedIn at the moment. Is the reality that education marketing is just incredibly fast-paced, or is most of that hype?
Yeah, I mean, I think marketing's probably one of the few sectors that changes every couple of years anyway. And if you want to throw in the education marketing angle, I guess for universities, we over-index for young people, because that's our core audience, right? So if you add in those two things, like a fast-paced sector, then you've got the youth element on top. I don't think it is hype. I think, yeah, it is a genuinely fast-paced profession to be in. The challenge we have is that we live in universities, and universities aren't typically known for that fast-paced change, unless it's COVID and we all have to. So I think it's a hard balance. I think in order to remain relevant in marketing today, you need to be almost relentlessly culturally relevant. The challenge of education marketing, therefore, is balancing the structures of organizations and those legacy structures with the need to continuously appeal to a youth audience.
Over the past year, I mean, I'm kind of over the talk of all the change of the pandemic, but like you just mentioned, it forced a lot of change in higher ed, which was good in so many ways. But now we're in kind of that post-pandemic era and the new normal, what do you think has been the biggest areas for change in the past year or so in marketing and higher ed?
I mean, there's a few things that have definitely kicked off in the last 2 years. I mean, the creator economy is a massive thing for me. You know, we see a lot of young people now not just aspiring to create content casually, but actually take that and build a living out of it. And, you know, I'm not just talking about being an influencer. There's a lot of data published by Adobe that shows that young people, they don't want to be influencers. They want to be creators and business owners. And that's a very different scope and lens to look at these things. They want to create content as a means to grow in a company and products. And I think that's wonderful. You know, you finally have the tools and technologies for one individual to scale these sort of ideas and these approaches. I've even seen a few universities tapping into this. East Carolina University has a creator course with Mr. Beast leading it. And, you know, it's a recruitment on-ramp for them. The course is online. Anyone in the world can study it. You don't have to study a full-time degree at the institution. But because of that, you have a lot of students discovering this course via Mr. Beast, this huge creator. And they study this short course. And then, funnily enough, they go on to study a full degree at the institution. So that's very exciting as a trend. And then there's obviously the implications of generative AI. And, you know, this is the biggest innovation since the dawn of the iPhone. And I know we're getting fatigued, and you did mention LinkedIn there, and I agree with you. I can't go through another 40-page carousel. It's going to kill me. But this is a profound shift, right? The closest proxy I have to it is, you think of how digital storage has come on in the last 50 years. You know, 5 megabytes used to be the size of a fridge, and now you can fit a terabyte on your fingernail. Well, that took like half a century to achieve. And what we're seeing with AI is it's happening in weeks and months. This is so fast. There's 100 million users using ChatGPT within, 2 months? It's 4 times faster than the growth of TikTok. You know, this is a platform, this is a destination, and we need to be on this. Could it cuts into every possible vertical?
I think it's amazing how many people, and I guess the fatigue I have is that whole, it's not as good as humans kind of panic, because, well, thank God, because we're rubbish. But what's amazing about it is the people are shutting it down rather than recognizing it is a challenge, you know, for academics. I think I saw something just the other week, and it was, look, okay, a small sample of like 400 or 500 students, but it was at Cambridge, and something like 40% had used ChatGPT as part of their writing. But I was like, you know, this is a real challenge for academics and students, because, you know, ChatGPT could be really helpful at starting a lot of work off for you, or helping you with your study notes, but where do you draw the line? How are you going to really assess that understanding and knowledge? You're right, that's probably one of the biggest challenges. And the Mr. Beast move was just absolute genius in terms of recognizing where people spend their time. Like, so many people have grown up with Mr. Beast as a key part of their content. You know, my kids love it, and they think he's altruistic and his content's fun. And so many students now see kind of the content or brand ambassador stuff as just like a side bit of income. They may want to integrate it into their careers. And yeah, I mean, whoever's managing a team of young professionals or even older millennials, why wouldn't you want to tap into a generation that has this kind of like skill set?
I mean, if anything, I think this whole creator angle and that idea of the individuals as a company, that almost is how we protect ourselves from any fallout from AI. Because if you think about how AI affects content creation, it almost commoditizes it, because now everyone can create. So, you know, content isn't that asset anymore. It isn't that store of value. But what is actually important off the back of that is the audience that someone, a person, can grow. And that person can use AI tools to scale their efforts, but it's not the company, it's the individual. So it's almost like the who becomes more important than the content in the future. So this is a shift that we're living through. And I feel that universities should be teaching young people, and have a responsibility to teach young people, how to tap into those skills that the creator economy has an offer.
Definitely. And look, you've been in the sector most of your career, at least the past decade, we were talking before, and you've experienced various institutions, both kind of in-house and now obviously as clients. How much do you feel that institutional culture, like you mentioned before, sometimes, you know, can be slow to change, but each institution, I kind of think, has its own, you know, way of being. How does that kind of impact how we really win at education marketing?
I think culture is quite telling, especially in the context of, you know, how universities are going about flexible work, right? I mean, there's some universities very much on the sort of hybrid train. Some are like really on the super remote one, you know, they're very flexible. And then others are trying to return to business as usual. And those universities, as you'd probably expect, are having a real problem with recruitment, because we already had a problem in higher ed that wages were slightly lower than the competitive average. If you look at roles in like web and development and that sort of stuff, I see these roles go up and they're hideously underneath like thresholds, and people are going, why aren't we recruiting? Well, you know, you're not offering flexibility and you're also paying under the rate. It's not a benefit on its own just to work in higher ed anymore. It's a sector like everything else. So this is a challenge, right? And if you look at how a modern workforce is made up, the majority of workers are now millennials and Gen Z, and they have radically different requirements in terms of being digital natives of what they expect their work to be. I mean, being a digital native, we all know the primary experience of life is a digital one. So you have a whole, well, two generations here, like, who expect to have work with a digital first approach, and they're not necessarily getting that. And if you compare like that to what I do day to day, right, I spend probably 95% of my time building community and digital channels for my own business. And I'm well known. I go and see people in person. I go to conferences. Like, being digital first doesn't affect your ability to form relationships. So I find it quite confusing when organizations aren't willing to embrace this, because it works. It's categorical evidence to suggest that, you know, having digital relationships doesn't detract from the real life. But we're going through a transition, aren't we? And I think a lot of these issues will probably be ironed out in the next 5 to 10 years. But for me, it can't really come soon enough. So I think the key is, if you're majority of your workforce is made up of digital natives, you kind of need to adapt your culture to suit that, really.
Yeah, and I think you then see it in the terms of how, you know, look, pre-pandemic, how many institutions were scared of or didn't do much of that kind of virtual open day and speak to students online or do live Q&As or anything like that. It was all about what they were broadcasting. And the pandemic forced a shift because, well, let's face it, financially, you just had to. And I think the way that young people want to learn and kind of experience their higher education is different. I do think that some now, and we're seeing that uptick in complaints, which I think is very interesting to the Office of Students, based on, you know, not pandemic issues, but in terms of quality of lectures, what they're receiving, just having it online, they're saying, well, is this worth the value? With all these like online free courses and different things, you're going to start getting this kind of sense of like, is this worth it? And that's going to be interesting for some universities, I think.
I mean, let's not forget as well that digital, you can build a best global in class offer, and anyone in the world can consume that content and learn on that course. And traditional education is built on geography, isn't it? Like, you go to the institution to study at it. And this is a battle, like, so if you're an applicant, you know, you have a choice to either study the best in class content remotely in the world, or you can go to a local institution and get an okay course, a decent course, but not the best. Like, genuinely, which one do you choose? Some people go for the in-person, right? Others go for digital. But you can't deny that the chance to study at the best institution in the world, the best course in the world digitally, isn't tempting. And these are the sort of competition lines that we now face ourselves, definitely over the next few years and beyond that.
And an unmissable trend within higher education has to be the evolution of TikTok and how teams approach the way they use that within their own content strategy. But like everything, it won't solve all challenges with content brand recruitment. We are obsessed with the bad stuff you see. You know, the vice chancellors have been rolled out on TikTok inexplicably, and it's just, you know, what are they doing? What are your thoughts on TikTok generally? You know, what have you observed when looking at what channel students are using and expecting? Because I know you shared something recently. I think there is this obsession, like, oh, everyone's on it. And I guess a bit like Snapchat, people, I remember when it sort of, I sound really old, I remember when Snapchat came out and everyone in higher was like, no, yes, not sure. And I remember doing some stuff with the students. They were like, well, it's okay if you have content, but we don't need to follow us. Like, it's not, we're not here to kind of speak to you here. And I guess that is that obsession with thinking that everyone's going to do everything through TikTok. Like, what's your take on it at the moment?
I think it's a great platform. Despite all the controversy happening around it and bans, and, you know, if one state bans it, it's going to cascade. And it probably will have multiple bans if that is the case. That aside, I still think it's a great opportunity for higher ed. I do feel it's misunderstood, and there's some particularly compelling data around this. There's a fantastic piece of research by the Keystone Education Group that looks at the top social media channels for students based on where they make study choices. 20,000 students, PG, UG, even PhD, right? So not only is it about social media, it's also actually using real student insight and data. And they determined that TikTok, in terms of helping students make study choices, is very low down that pecking order. It's something ridiculously low, like 3.9% out of that huge sample size. And Instagram comes out on top as this destination. It's also more universal. It's used in multiple countries across the world, whereas TikTok is adopted more in other countries than others. So that doesn't mean that students aren't using TikTok. It just means they're using it for different purposes. The number one reason people use TikTok is for mindless entertainment and comedy. I don't think this is a surprise, but we seem to forget that in higher ed. So a lot of universities don't use it in that way. I can probably count on one hand how many that do, and do it consistently and do it well. Chichester's the kind of poster child for this. They're fantastic, they're funny, they have the permission to create content like that. Most universities don't. And I'm not saying those who don't shouldn't post on TikTok, because they still get traction, but you're never going to really engage with a student audience unless you're following that sort of comedic trend and you really lean into it. You're never going to get the massive results unless you do that. So there are some caveats to that. TikTok's released a new STEM feed, so, you know, you could actually publish scientific content on there that gets young people engaged in this sort of thing and still win. But the real win for TikTok and the engagement and to reach students is to publish more on the kind of mindless entertainment and comedy side. If you're not doing that, it's fine. Just don't use it. Use a different channel like Instagram. It's okay. But yeah, don't just be there because you feel you have to be.
And also realistic about what you're going to get from that. I think you're right. It's having that lens of you're joining their party. So it's kind of reflecting what the conversation is back to yourselves. I think the STEM stuff's exciting, and I think there is a place for interesting facts, but presented in a way that links to trends or what is being current. I agree. It's an interesting one. Look, we've spoken previously about the slightly stereotypical approach when it comes to youth marketing. When it comes to higher ed content, what are some of the traps that are easy to fall into?
Sure. I mean, I think a consistent theme there is this idea of authenticity. I attend so many webinars and research much material in the sector that students want us to be authentic and they want real experiences. And I question this because there's a lot of trends that suggest actually that's not necessarily what people want. If you look at TikTok, for instance, right? You know, if you ask someone to describe their typical TikTok experience, they normally say, "Oh, I'm going down a rabbit hole for like half an hour. It's an attention suck. I've woke up like an hour later. I don't know where my life has gone." And that to me doesn't suggest authenticity. It almost suggests escape, which is the opposite. It's like an entertainment platform. And then you've got something like BeReal. And again, we all say, oh, it's about being authentic. But actually, there's like GWI did a piece on this. They asked BeReal users why they use it. And the number one reason is simplicity. So the idea that it's one action and one thing that people do and it's just familiar. Authenticity is way down the list. So I think authenticity is true to some extent, right? I don't, you know, I'm not going to derail peer-to-peer or anything like that, but I don't think it's as important as we believe. And I think if we're always trying to present like real faces, real people, and just lose out on the entertainment angle, like we just spoke about with TikTok there, and the ability to make people engage and laugh and be entertained, then I think we'll lose, leaving a lot of value on the table. So next time someone tells you to be authentic or you hear it in a webinar, just question it. Because I think a lot of the cases, it's a myth that's sort of grown over time when really a lot of the data in terms of like, you know, we binge watch Netflix and we just disappear, don't we? We want to chill out. It's perfectly normal, but there's not a lot of people talking about that. And for me, that's what discovery is about. You don't look at a creator, you just tap into your social media app and then all that personalized content just sucks you in for like half an hour. That's escape. It's not being authentic.
So make it go viral has to be one of the most terrifying terms you'll hear from a senior person at a university, and we've all heard it. So when it comes to managing up and ensuring that you kind of take senior staff on the right journey when it comes to content strategy, what's your approach?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I live in like the content marketing sphere, so I'm not in the business of making things go viral, but typically I have a template that I use to talk about content marketing projects. I mean, anyone can use it. It's educationmarketer.co.uk/stakeholders. And essentially it's a template that helps you pitch a content marketing idea, but most importantly, highlight that with any sort of content marketing initiative, you're looking at between 12 and 18 months before you get a return. And that return comes from being consistent, growing an audience over time. The other thing to think about virality is that when companies and brands go viral, they very rarely get any business benefit off the back of that. They get the traction, but if you think about what a viral piece of content is, it has to be generic enough to appeal to a vast amount of people, an undifferentiated audience that share some sort of common aspect. But that common aspect is rarely the service or some sort of linked theme to the thing that you offer. It's the lowest common denominator, right? So it's a like, it's a share, but no one's going to purchase anything off the back of it. The real benefits you get from content is when people over time recognize you for a certain thing, that you represent something, and then they get in touch with you when you're ready to buy. So I usually bring those things to the table. And you know, personally, it's so funny, but my highest performing LinkedIn posts are usually the least likely to lead to business. It's the ones that I talk about weird topics that hardly get any traction that actually lead to DMs, that lead to, you know, projects. It's funny, isn't it? Right. But yeah, these are the things that happen behind the scenes.
I think you made me think then about the importance of having a really robust sort of measurement and evaluation framework. Yeah. I've been using AMEC for some time, which is really helpful, but just in terms of that, not just going, well, it's about likes and shares and numbers, and actually trying to educate and bring those leaders on with you, kind of joining all those dots, going, this is a content strategy we're going to have. And the consistent messaging, I think, there is so important that over a year to 18 months, people will come on that journey with you. The numbers and the metrics and that kind of, it'll go viral. And just that thing that I guess, unfortunately, some senior leaders might just assume is good, can be the downfall of any project.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, likes, shares, comments, engagements, I think this is all useful stuff. But, you know, typically I use them as indicators, i.e. that something is resonating. The actual evaluation of a content marketing strategy uses different metrics, like did this campaign, this content marketing initiative you put together, improve conversion in this part of the funnel? Or did people who subscribe to these programs convert quicker? Are they more likely to enroll? Those are the things that you need to do to prove return and what you're doing. You know, likes and shares are useful to work out if it's kind of working, but yeah, you need to ask the real questions a bit further down the line.
Are there any books or podcasts or talks that you'd recommend that could help us better understand education marketing or engaging youth audiences?
Yeah, I mean, there's a fantastic insights and consultancy firm called Beano Brain, and it's actually part of the Beano group. It's their youth insights arm, and the data they have, especially on younger audiences like Generation A, it's just exceptional. The survey sizes are huge. They typically, well, they sometimes interview global audiences, but they usually live in like the UK or US. And I've seen some great stuff coming out of them. They did like a top 10 brands of Generation A, YouTube at the top there. They did a deep dive into millennial parents and all that sort of stuff. And these are topics I find fascinating, because these are sort of, I'm a millennial parent myself, so it's interesting to see what's being said. But yeah, they are incredible. In terms of podcasting, I listen to quite a few, really. I think the one that's been most impactful to me over the years has to be This Old Marketing, which is a content marketing focused podcast. But it takes the idea of marketing and like splices it with media, and it feels very refreshing to hear like items of marketing news discussed in a different context. And I've listened to that for since right at the beginning of my career. And it's not an education marketing podcast, but you know, if you listen to this thing for like a couple of months, it will change the way you look at the landscape. And, you know, if I hadn't heard that podcast early in my career, I probably wouldn't be working in the field I'm in today.
Last question. What is the one stereotype about young people that you think everyone needs to throw in the bin?
That they have short attention spans. They really don't. If someone isn't engaging with your content, it's not that person's attention span. It's the content that you're putting in front of them. This is the same generation that are happy to lose themselves in TikTok for a couple of hours, you know, no break, binge series on Netflix. Attention span isn't the issue, it's the content that's on offer.
It is a really, really poor stereotype. I think that's a really good example of how if they're into the content, they will binge it for hours. It's not them, it's you.
Yeah, that's it. That's the message I want to leave people with.
I love that. It's not them, it's you, from Kyle. Well, thanks so much for coming on today. It's been a really great chat.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It's been great.
Thanks for listening to the Hear It podcast. If you like what you heard, please rate, review and subscribe, as it really helps others find us. You can also follow us on Twitter @Hear It Podcast or drop us a message by emailing info@threadandfable.com.